Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Buongiorno. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is film historian Bill Crone. Say hello, Bill.
Hello, everybody.
Bill is the Hollywood correspondent for the French film journal Cahiers du Cinéma, and he's also written several books, including ones on Alfred Hitchcock and Stanley Kubrick. But today he's joining us to chat about the Sight and Sound Critics Poll's 21st greatest film of all time, Michelangelo Antonioni's La Ventura. For a film that's at least in part about apathy, it sure inspires a lot of enthusiasm from the critics. We're going to talk about why the film continues to be held in such high regard, and we're going to assess whether it's worthy of the acclaim. Then, for our second topic, we're going to talk about Bill's recent participation in the French Cinémathèque's retrospective of the films of Phil Carlson. Carlson is a director whose world's apart from Antonioni, both in terms of geography and public awareness. I know many listeners probably aren't familiar with much of Carlson's work, but hopefully we will remedy that very shortly. And finally, we're going to wrap up the show with a couple of final notes of positivity. Are you ready, Bill?
Let's shoot.
All right, let the adventure begin. First up, we're going to talk about the 21st greatest movie of all time, Michelangelo Antonioni's 1960 Italian feature, La Ventura. La Ventura is about a trio of wealthy, beautiful people who go on a yachting trip along the coast of Sicily with a couple of other equally wealthy and disaffected Italian socialites. This trio consists of a young woman named Anna, played by Leah Massari, Anna's best friend Claudia, played by Monica Vitti, and Anna's boyfriend slash almost fiancé slash they're in a weird place, Sandro, played by Gabriele Frazetti. The group, at least initially, appear to be enjoying their boating expedition. That is, until they make a pit stop at a mysterious island. While on the island, Claudia does a little exploring, while Anna and Sandro bicker about the extended length of Sandro's recent business trips. A short amount of time passes, and the band of travelers manages to occupy themselves. But when the weather turns, it is decided that they should make haste for land. Unfortunately, no one seems to be able to find Anna. She appears to have gone missing without a trace. The mystery is set, but just when the audience starts to anticipate the arrival of Miss Jean Marple, Antonioni subverts our expectations and has Sandro corner Claudia on the yacht and give her a passionate kiss. The remainder of the film follows Sandro and Claudia's tumultuous love affair, while the search for Anna recedes into the background. So let's get into it, shall we?
Yes.
All right. So, do you like La Ventura?
Love it.
All right. Why?
Because it is one of the films that began what at the Cahiers we refer to as modernism. It was the same year as Psycho. And because I'm doing a book on serial killer cinema, which is a work in progress, I'm deeply interested in Psycho, which is also, I consider, the beginning of modern cinema. And it's interesting to me now, I certainly didn't know this at the time, to see the similarities between the two films, because they both begin with focus on a character who then disappears about 20 minutes into the film, and then it becomes a film about somebody else. Mm-hmm. It becomes a film about Monica Vitti. And, you know, there are a lot of other little similarities, like you can see there's a sex scene before the disappearance and all those things. And I kind of think of and really the Cahiers du Cinéma did too at the time, think of them as the two beginnings of modernism, Psycho and La Ventura, as strange as that may sound today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, well, let's compare and contrast the two films as far as, I mean, the setup is very similar. You're right. I hadn't thought about it, but the style couldn't be farther apart. Maybe we should talk a little bit about Antonioni's style and perhaps why some people don't take to the movie immediately. I think it's not as accessible to American audiences in the way that Psycho seems mm-hmm. to be. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, the thing about Antonioni back then, I was just reading an interview with George Cukor, where he said that he really admired some things in La Ventura, but he couldn't stand the pace. I don't think that would have been a problem with Hitchcock himself, who was an avid student of Antonioni's films and needed, and actually when he was making Torn Curtain, he had the Italian representative of Universal Pictures find out what lab had been used to develop Red Desert and what procedures were used to get those colors. So it was not a, but that's up on the level of master to master. People here didn't like it, probably because of the slow pace. It was unusual, and I understand really from reading in the Cahiers that there were boos all the way through the Cannes premiere.
Right.
Because every time something would happen that didn't advance the narrative, the spectators said, "What the hell are we looking at?" Right. You know.
So, what was your initial reaction to the film, and how has it changed?
Mm-hmm. My initial reaction to La Ventura probably happened when I was at Yale in 1963, and it's probably something I saw at the Yale Film Society. I had friends from California who were much hipper than me. I came from a small town in Texas, and I'd been at a nice prep school for 3 years, but, you know, I had to sneak away from a town trip to see Shoot the Piano Player, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. So my hip friends from California knew all about Antonioni. And I remember when Red Desert came out and was reviewed by Stanley Kaufman in the New Republic, an old lion of a film critic who reliably got everything wrong except stuff coming out of Italian neorealism. Everybody has their period.
Yeah.
And that was Kaufman's. He came up and showed us Olmi and talked about Red Desert. And his review of Red Desert was considered by my California friends to be the greatest piece of film criticism ever written. And I look back at it, and it's a damn good piece of film criticism. So at that point, I was probably picking it up as fast as I could from my California friends and my dear late friend John Doerr, who was running the Yale Film Society at the time, also became a great filmmaker in his own right. And I was immediately impressed. I did not have any problems with the link. But of course, I had had my head filled with all sorts of... This was a period when I was looking at the Cahiers at the Yale Library to see what films to see, even though I couldn't read French. But it was very apparent to me that, you know, if they said it was like Howard Hawks, then I loved Howard Hawks, and that was fine with me.
Yeah, and you don't remember your initial reaction?
My initial reaction would have been to fall in love with Monica Vitti.
Okay,
I would assume. Yeah.
You're only human.
And that has lasted and lasted and lasted. And I just think, I remember when I was hitchhiking in Europe, in Italy, I had gone to Europe with some friends. This was my sophomore year, so it would be 64. And they wanted to go to Germany. I didn't want to go to Germany, so I bailed out and hitchhiked through Italy. And I was stopping in a working man's sort of lunch place where all the working men went to have lunch. And we could not converse in any language except cinema.
Mm.
I would say John Wayne, they'd say Rio Bravo, and so on and so on. So finally I said, Monica Vitti, or no, I said, I probably said Antonioni. Mm-hmm. And the guys in the in the cafe said Monica Vitti Antonioni. Or like that. That I got. That language I understood. Yeah. And George Cukor said that the first time Katharine Hepburn appeared on the screen, nobody had ever seen a face like that before. And it was the same thing with Vitti, but he was able to convey his enormous love through the image and through a series of absolutely astonishing films, you know, of which I consider Red Desert to be, you know, how do you compare masterpieces? You know, Red Desert and all the color films afterwards are gigantic films. But La Ventura has that sort of cusp beauty to it, that it came at just the moment where everything came together in people's minds, and we were suddenly in a new era of cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. The film is, as we discussed, there are two very distinct parts to this film. There's the part with Anna and the part without Anna. Mm-hmm. What do you make of Anna's disappearance?
At the time, I was being educated not to look for that answer.
Mm.
But what I noticed and was proud of myself for noticing is that when they leave the empty modern city that I think Anna's father is building and it still isn't occupied, there's a tracking shot following them. And there's nobody in the city who could be following them. So I said, well, that's her ghost.
Mm.
But in terms of what happened, her father says she couldn't have committed suicide. She could have. I'm inclined to think it was something bad just because of the relationship with Psycho. But no, I suspended. I was learning how to suspend those questions when I saw, particularly in a foreign film.
Yeah.
And, of course, Pauline Kael was telling everybody that it was absolutely a dreadful violation of film history that was full of films that moved and crackled and blah, 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 blah. And she referred to all of this in a famous article, Come Dressed as the Sick Soul of Europe, where she talked about the walk, and she talked about how Monica Vitti walked and aimlessly and so on, and how this was supposed to be a symbol of alienation. And I just thought all of that was utter bilge. And to me, it was an exciting film. It wasn't... And incidentally, I think Manny Farber, who was the person Kael was copying religiously in those days, thought so too.
Mm, okay. Yeah, I think initially she really liked La Ventura, and then when everyone else started getting on board, she, the ultimate contrarian.
Oh, well, that's very valuable to know.
Yeah.
So in other words, she flipped.
I think she reversed herself. It was Antonioni's later films that she really couldn't... Then she started bashing him.
Oh, Eclipse. Yeah, and La Notte, yeah.
Let's talk about... This is, as you mentioned, the dawning of the modern era. How does this film differ from its predecessors?
Modernism is about a character looking at her society and seeing it as a series of false appearances. The world in La Ventura looks terribly real, but at the same time, there is something about it that is terribly unreal to her. And that becomes more and more apparent by the time you get to Red Desert. She's seeing the way the world has changed and is changing. The industrialization of northern Italy, the beginning of modern architecture, and all that is the coming of a time when spectators of films, stood back, identified with people who were kind of lost in this new world and seeing it as a series of false images. And that was the position of the alienated petit bourgeois spectator, as we say at the Cahiers. And that petit bourgeois includes everybody, really, because cinema is made for everybody. But that particular group of people were alienated from the power of the big bourgeoisie. And they were looking at modern society. And this is something that doesn't have to be Italian. You know, you can see it in Frank Tashlin. You can see it in a lot of people, and saying, this isn't real somehow. This is false appearances. And the material that goes into creating those false appearances, advertising images, posters, everything, comic strips. Antonioni loved comic strips, studied them. All these new images that were turning the world into a kind of ghost of itself. And that's why you see those images so much in Antonioni. He films every brand name known to Earth in Zabriskie Point, but he films it like pop art, you know? That gives us a different way of talking about La Ventura. And it's not ersatz. I mean, Antonioni loved modernity, but it is a place where peasants and people like peasants are simply not going to have much place anymore. And that clearing out of the world by modernity is one of the things that Romare talks about, too. Mm-hmm. Very close to Antonioni in some respects, because, he made a film about the fact that the peasants aren't going to have any place to farm anymore pretty soon. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
So for me, it's not about existentialism, although existentialism was certainly in the air, therefore alienation. Therefore, all these big concepts that Stanley Kaufman and whoever used, it's really about the coming of a modern world that is eventually, don't forget, this is 1960, there's going to be a mass revolution in 1968 against that world.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, Sandro is an architect, mm-hmm. and he's talking very explicitly about how these ancient buildings were built to last for centuries, and now we make buildings that are meant to last maybe 10 years. And it seems like a huge part of that, he's very resentful mm-hmm. of modernity. I wonder if Antonioni, do you think that the Sandro character is sort of Antonioni's proxy?
Sandro is Antonioni's proxy.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in some ways he's also the most villainous character.
Well, you know, that's not something Antonioni would quail at.
Yeah.
No, he's a sort of a son of a bitch. And, you know, we could say this about that. He isn't Antonioni. He's Antonioni's stand-in to sleep with Monica Vitti.
Yeah.
And while Antonioni watches. And this is another figure of modernism that I hadn't thought of applying to this film, but it certainly does, the castrated metteur en scène. In Bresson, and in the Bresson model, as it was referred to in the Cahiers, you have a shot of the actress in Trial of Joan of Arc, and then you have a shot of one of the judges who's persecuting her. It's a very simple mise-en-scene, back and forth like that. The third person in all of this is Bresson himself, who kind of appears in the cuts between the shots, in a sense. And this was something that all the Italians did, consciously. The director or the director character, if he's in the film, watches while a torturer does something terrible to a woman. And it can be something very minor, like not kissing her goodbye or something. It doesn't have to be something absolutely horrible, but it can be the kinds of things that Sandro does. Let's put it that way. Mm. Sandro's a pig.
Yeah.
And Antonioni, watching him be a pig and watching him inflict what he inflicts on Monica Vitti, is letting him do it for him. Let me put it that way.
Mm, interesting. Okay. The Monica Vitti character is so fascinating. One, because, I mean, she's captivating to look at.
Yeah.
And also, she's impossible to read. In many ways, like, you watch her on this island, and on these jagged rocks, and there's, you know, water churning beneath her, uh-huh. but she remains this pillar of tranquility in this movie.
She is very tranquil. She was a very fun-loving person and had only done comedies up until then, you know. So by having her sort of assume that Madonna appearance, Antonioni was certainly violating her personality from the get-go. And yes, her tranquility, which is sort of, I would once again say, Madonna-like, because these things don't go away, particularly in Italy. That imagery, you know, doesn't, we don't forget about it overnight. And what you, so I would say, yes, she is a Madonna. She is tranquil. And that's why she must be tortured.
Mm. Let's talk about the pacing and the cinematography. I know we touched on it briefly, but I think that is a huge part of Antonioni's style,
mm-hmm.
and really gives it the sense of the ambiance, and I feel like a lot of its meaning comes from the pacing.
That's because he's showing you pieces of time. He's filming time. When he does those long takes, mm-hmm. those are pieces of time. Those are chunks of duration. That's what it feels like to live through 4 minutes instead of seeing it all cut up.
Right.
And those pieces of time, to borrow an image from, a word from Peter Bogdanovich, is what neorealism did. And it's what he's still doing in this film. And that's what LaBarthe meant when he said blocks of time, because so much of this film is actually chunks of time, which you experience in the moment.
Yeah.
As it's passing. And that experience of time passing is what Antonioni is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I'm watching the film, I'm obviously every single shot is gorgeous. But because of the slow pacing, it's like you do start to feel a little bit restless sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like I'm staring at this gorgeous image, and yet I'm already anticipating the next one and mm-hmm. waiting for it. Mm-hmm. That was sort of my reaction as I was watching the film.
The first time?
Yeah.
How many times have you seen it?
I've only seen it twice.
I think you'll find that when you go back to it, you'll be seeing it. You'll be experiencing time and realizing that you're experiencing time. Look, George Cukor was doing this stuff in 1962. I just watched Let's Make Love with Marilyn Monroe. I'm doing an article on Cukor. And these guys were all doing it. Everybody, at the point where it became possible to film time, they all, the great filmmakers,
yeah.
and I put Cukor on the same level as Antonioni.
So do I.
All started filming time.
Yeah.
Because they could.
Yeah. And I think the pacing helps construct the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows us to really get into the character's headspace. We really feel the passage of time mm-hmm. in the film.
Mm-hmm. And he is, he's simply consummate at that. And I think he actually got bored with doing it sort of later. I think The Passenger is a very slow movie, but I think later he decided, well, let's do some cutting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because he's still filming the same people and the same things.
So in my overview, my very brief overview, I mentioned that the film is at least in part about apathy. Would you agree with that assertion?
Apathy. Sure.
Sure.
Those people are apathetic, and they're apathetic because they are upper class, and they don't have a hell of a lot to do besides, you know, take boat trips and go on picnics and build useless towns and to have sex.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, they are that, you could say, Fitzgeraldian view of the upper class. And Antonioni actually had access to those people. He knew them. So in filming their psychology, as well as their bodies and their homes and the forms through which they evolve, he was filming real apathy, I think. I think they were probably very apathetic.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, as I mentioned, this is the 21st movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Do you feel it is worthy of that position?
I don't feel that the critics who do that poll are worthy of their positions.
Okay.
So I don't, for the most part. So I don't think they are worthy to judge.
Okay.
Antonioni. And I think they were wrong when they made Vertigo the number one film. I think it should be Psycho.
Really? All right.
Which one do you think it should
be? Well, I think it should be Citizen Kane. It's because it's always got to be Citizen Kane.
Well, it's always got to be Citizen... No. I would actually, between the two modernists, Wells and Hitchcock, as of Psycho, I would give the palm to Psycho.
Really?
And I've been saying that for years, and people have been looking at me like, yeah? And, I have gradually seen people come around to my point of view.
Yeah, well, between Vertigo and Psycho, I'm definitely a Psycho girl. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you talk about black and white cinematography, and you talk about real time. He was filming conversations with multiple cameras, so he wouldn't have to break into the flow of the actors riffing mm-hmm. with each other and stuff like that. Always very, very, very modern.
All right.
And we're talking about Psycho, folks.
Yes.
Because I tend to talk for a long time. Okay.
So let's bring it back to La Ventura. While the critics on this poll may not be worthy of judging Antonioni, what is your overall opinion?
I looked at this movie again recently. I have it on tape. I had started discovering YouTube. And I had found some of his early documentaries, which I was watching. And I said, oh, I'll just take a look at this thing. Oh, my God. And then I simply sat down and watched everything straight through. And after I finished with him, I moved on to Visconti. And after I finished with him, I moved on to post-war Rossellini. And after I finished with him, I moved on to Pasolini.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the greatness of La Ventura that made me want to drink so deeply from that well again.
Let's end it with that. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Bill is involved with an upcoming retrospective put on by the French Cinémathèque of the films of Phil Carlson. He's written the catalog article that will accompany the retrospective. And for those of us who can't read French, Bill will also be writing a longer article in English, which will be available in a collection of his work that's being published by NYU Press. So, let's start this thing off. Who is Phil Carlson?
Good question.
Good.
The one time I happened to see him, I looked right through him because I was 10 years old. I had been taken with my family, we were really out there to go to Disneyland. a sound man named Harry Lundgren, who was a friend of ours, who was also the sound man on Rear Window, to see a movie being shot. We went to the set of Hell's Island with Mary Murphy and John Payne. And I saw one shot being filmed. And it was Mary Murphy lying on a couch, reading a fashion magazine, getting up and walking over to the other side of the room and lighting a cigarette. And I think they had to do it three times. And I said, that's filmmaking? That's the slowest, most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. But I was fascinated. I kept the script, which Harry gave me. And only years later did I realize that I had seen Phil, because Phil Carlson directed that movie. He directed, and incidentally, those of you who have Amazon Prime can actually see Hell's Island. I only realized, obviously, about 3 years ago that the man I had seen was not just the director of 99 River Street, but also a great director, period, who went through a remarkable evolution from the time he made his first films for Monogram to films like The Big Cat and Black Gold, which are really, I think the term today is progressive films. But, you know, Phil was a real progressive. I think he was one of those people coming up in the post-war era who, if Truman hadn't signed the National Security Act in 1947-48, might have had a great William Wyler-type career making progressive films with big budgets. But I don't think he could have put up with all the nonsense that William Wyler, a distinctly inferior director, in my opinion, was willing to put up with to make stuff like The Best Years of Our Lives. I think he was much better off, much happier, and this is something I learned much later when I was able to actually go to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Library and get out every single production document on Hell's Island. I felt that there was something that began there for me, and it was a duty to make the most invisible great post-war director of B-movies visible.
Okay.
Despite his lifelong attempts to be invisible.
So can you maybe just walk us through his career, where it started? And
By the way, I'm very grateful for any opportunity that I have to put this out, because I really want people to start paying attention. And I believe now that the French Cinematheque is doing a complete retrospective, we're going to see retrospectives here and so on. But people need to be prepared, because it's not a normal career. The first part of, may I refer to him as Phil?
Sure. I'll allow it.
Thank you. So Phil started off at the, it was kind of, think of it as a Preston Sturges situation. His father was a lawyer. His mother was an actress. His mother was an Irish actress who was a hit on the Yiddish stage. And his father must have been named Carlstein, although very little is known about him. So Phil was Irish and Jewish. So he went to the Chicago Art Institute. He studied painting. His dad said, okay, but if you're going to be an artist, you have to get a law degree at least. Mm-hmm. So he went to Marymount. And while he was at Marymount, he was a gaffer and did little jobs on sets at Universal and gradually worked his way up to being an assistant director. One of the films he was an assistant director on, very last one, was with Lou Costello of Abbott and Costello. And I know there are people in your audience who don't know who Abbott and Costello are. very, very funny men who made many wonderful movies at Universal. But, you know, they were the sort of cheap Marx Brothers. They weren't really, you know, the Marx Brothers were at MGM. These guys were at Universal. And Lou Costello, the fat, funny one, secretly financed Phil's first film, a feature called A Wave, a Whack, and a Marine, which was made at Monogram, but with more money than Monogram probably had in the bank at that time. They built these huge sets, and it bombed because people weren't ready for it. It was something so sophisticated that he ended up working at Monogram on film shot in basically 1 week. And that's where he really showed his genius. But you have to look at these films. And I revisit them regularly. A film like Behind the Mask, I could see right now.
Mm-hmm.
And just like L'Aventura.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Monogram period, during which he continued to be a progressive filmmaker, even though he was working, or particularly because he was working on low budgets, came The Blacklist. And during the period of The Blacklist, he mostly worked at Columbia, which was making B-movies, B-westerns, and made programmers that were about The Blacklist. They were westerns, or they were adventure films, but there was always somebody who was being accused of sending letters to the enemy and getting money from the enemy. You can tell it's the mm-hmm. McCarthy era. And it was out of that that he created, and it was again Monogram that produced them. Remember that name, folks, Monogram. It became Allied Artists. You probably heard of Allied Artists just because they made, Invasion of the Body Snatchers and a few little gems like that. For that, they were Monogram. Is my dog bothering you?
That noise you hear is a little dog rubbing himself on the carpet.
anyway, Phil always had a good nose for where the good stuff was, mm-hmm. you know. But what you see in Behind the Mask, which I do recommend also to your readers, is the masterpiece, probably, of his Monogram period. And I really want people who love film to know more about Monogram, mm-hmm. because that no-frills style is where cinema comes from. It comes from Griffith. And as my late friend John Doerr, whom I alluded to earlier in this broadcast, the guy who ran the Yale Film Society, D-O-R-R, also a great filmmaker in his own right, said that the Monogram style was the continuation of the Griffith style, the style from which movies sprang.
Yeah.
And if you want to see what Phil Carlstein of the Chicago Art Institute, by way of the Universal backlot, came up with when he was handed that tool. Okay, back to grade school, kid. This is it. Mm-hmm. It's called Behind the Mask.
So listeners should make sure to watch Behind the Mask. One film that I believe you said in your article that was his biggest box office success, was it Walking Tall?
Walking Tall.
Yes, and which some people may know because they actually did a remake of it, right? With The Rock.
Dwayne.
Yes.
One of my favorite actors. I just didn't go see it because, you know, I don't get to movies very much, but I don't have anything against people remaking Phil.
Okay, yeah. I think it brought a lot of attention to the original. Yeah. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the original film.
Very funny.
Mm.
Pauline Kael called it a fascist film.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, she would.
Andrew Saris liked it.
Okay.
And I loved it.
Okay.
And even though I was going around spouting quotes from Chairman Mao at the time, literally, uh-huh. all my friends were Maoists in New York when we went to see it, living in the gutter practically. it didn't look like a fascist film to me.
Yeah.
And when I did hook up with the Cahiers and I wrote an early, very early letter from Hollywood, that was what my column I was doing in those days was called, I referenced Framed, which is a film so horrifying about vengeance that I haven't been able to make myself watch it again. And it's in the wrong aspect ratio, so I'm waiting. But Framed was Phil's swan song. Those two films, which he financed with his own money, made him a rich man. Wow. And what he did was go back to his roots. You know, he had been toying around with studio filmmaking. He had done some big pictures. Now he put his own money up. He went to the equivalent of Allied artists and made these two pictures and oversaw the distribution, became a wealthy man. But it was a return for him to his roots, really. And for me, you know, I come from the South. It didn't look particularly untrue to me.
Yeah.
You know, I know that neck of the woods. I think what Mao Tse-tung said could be the epigram to Framed, Phil's last film. It was already used by Sergio Leone as the epigram to Duck, You Sucker. Revolution isn't a dinner party.
Well, I think the vigilanteism is a theme in a couple of the movies, right? So right. I saw 99 River Street and Walking Tall.
It's revenge, but it's not vigilantism.
Okay.
As I point out in my little article, which you're free to post on your website if you want, Phil was making his noirs during a period when civil rights were just starting up and there were a lot of lynchings going on in the South. So the last thing on earth he wanted to preach was vigilantism.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that in Phoenix City, but since you've seen 99 River Street, that's just a guy on a personal vendetta, right? He comes closer to it in some of the other films, but he always keeps it personal and lets it be a metaphor for what he's really feeling.
So just to wrap things up, if people want to delve further into Carlson's work, what are the top five movies that will start you out? Or top three?
A Wave of Whack in the Marine, Phoenix City Story, Hell to Eternity.
Okay.
Which is a war movie based on the true story of a Mexican kid who was adopted by a Japanese family when he was orphaned. They were interned during World War II. This is the first time you ever see internment in an American film. It was a B-movie. He could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, or a programmer. In the second act, he enrolls to fight the Japanese. And the whole second act is an orgy scene in Honolulu.
Wow.
like Faces, but 10 years earlier. That kind
of
scene.
Wow, okay.
And the third scene is him stopping the Japanese, because he speaks Japanese, from committing mass suicide after Iwo Jima.
Mm.
It's one of the most astonishing. You want to talk about a mixed bag. Act one, act two, act three. The one thing that Phil told the only people that interviewed him was that I learned something at Monogram, which is you got to have first act, second act, third act. What he forgot to mention is that they have to be totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, and you can see the greatness of Phil's anti-racist vision in Hell to Eternity. Those are the three I would definitely push.
All right, listeners, you've got some homework, I guess. It's time to bring the show to an end. But before we set sail, we'll leave you with our final notes of positivity. Bill, what's one cultural thing that you've been enjoying lately?
Comic books.
All right.
And basically only comic books. I happen to live near Meltdown, and I have been discovering something that both of our filmmakers, Bill Carlson and Michelangelo Antonioni knew very well, which is the comic books are one of America's great art forms. And they were already in the 50s when Frontline Combat, which I just bought a replica of, it's not, if this was the original issue, it would be worth thousands of dollars. It's a replica of an EC comic of the 50s when we were all fighting communism on the ground, in the air, everywhere we could. And there's this kid who is a spotter, a humble spotter. Oh, I'm not going to go play baseball now. I have a spotter job to do. And he spots an F-94 coming in, and he tells the Pentagon, this is drawn exquisitely. This is, if it's not Wallace Wood, it's somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And F-86 Sabre jet, this is the Air Force issue. This is where kids would learn about all the different planes that we used. And it is so exquisitely drawn to give you the sensation of being in aerial combat in the fog. You know, it's a and B-26 Invader lets you feel what it's like, see what it's like to go on a bombing mission in Korea, setting off explosions on the ground that make a river of light. Something you may have seen in anti-war films, say about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Here it was right in our neighborhood cigar store. And it was supposedly to show us the goodness of America. And let's put it this way. The message hasn't held up too well, but art is eternal.
All right. And so it's called what?
Frontline Combat.
And do we have an author?
Several. But I think the auteur in the strict sense is EC Comics.
Okay. And just to be clear, Meltdown is a comic book store in Hollywood, and it's a treasure. Right. Is that fair to say?
And I am only too happy to plug it.
Yeah. My final note of positivity. It's funny, I've been thinking about rebranding this segment A Touch of Zen after the movie, but I think that transitions nicely into my item for today. I've been reading Scott Stossel's book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, and I found it oddly comforting. Not only is it really interesting when it delves into the history of psychotropic pharmaceuticals, but it's also a great relief to know that I'm not alone in my various anxieties and phobias. Turns out that the world was built by a whole bunch of people with very weak stomachs, just like mine.
Oh, all that. That opens the whole topic. It didn't start yesterday.
Yes. No. I mean, yes, I'm definitely gathering that from the book.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the book is fascinating. The history.
What?
And I didn't know anything about tranquilizers. It had always been around in my life, or in fact, I mean, they've gone out of
You've
style.
You've heard Mother's and, Little Helper.
Precisely, right? Yeah. So, but I didn't know anything about Milton or Milltown, exactly, or any of these other things. So, it's all Xanax in my day, you know.
knew of them, and growing up in that era, I was well aware that there was all this pill popping going on, but it wasn't happening around me.
Scott Stossel is fascinating. All of his anxieties, I mean, he's a basket case, and yet he's very successful.
That's
very comforting.
That's good
very
to know.
Very comforting.
That's good. I don't disbelieve in it at all.
I mean,
I believe in all of it.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, Scott Stossel, he doesn't have a definitive opinion. He's just sort of laying everything out, the history, and he goes through what he's done to help alleviate some of his anxiety, which is a combination of, behavioral therapy and medication and drugs. So, but yeah, that's Scott Stossel's My Age of Anxiety. Scott Stossel is, I believe, an editor for The Atlantic. He's also, he's written for The New Yorker and
those are all
several other
great magazines.
Yeah, but, you know, I highly recommend it. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. So, listeners, what do you think of La Ventura? What's your favorite Phil Carlson flick? Come tell us on our website, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And most important of all, if you dug the show, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Next up on our sight and sound list is a little movie called The Godfather. Ever heard of it, Bill?
I saw it when it came out.
Yeah. Some Coppola guy, I don't know.
A little overrated, it's not bad.
We're going to chat about it and bring it forth to the masses. Until then, Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me and giving me a chance to spread the word about Phil.
All right, and we'll make sure to post your article on our website as well. Until next time, a presto, huh?
Arrivederci.
Arrivederci.